We have some time for question and discussion. So, it's, yeah, Dr. Oberleitner.
Whether there are studies on the relation or the association between polystyrene concentration and mortality. Polystyrene
and osteron.
Osteron concentration, mortality. I'm relating to the Bain study, which has basically shown that, for example, cardiac function is improved when spironolactone, like the other, is given. So, is there any other study in that information?
I think you're so. So there are studies, they're not mortality studies. I mean, there's one study that was, small study that was published with mineralocorticoid antagonists looking at LV mass and suggesting there is a benefit. I'm not aware that there are mortality studies with looking at serum aldosterone. It's an interesting question because if it really does change the underlying structural heart disease, you might think there would be a change in mortality. So the fact that somebody can demonstrate a change in LV mass or fibrosis is interesting. It's just, at this point, I'd say it's still a bit speculative.
Dr. Delgadas?
Yeah, John Delgadas from Chicago. Well, this is a question for Dr. Herzog. What do you think about this idea now of using, there's a lot of excitement about using patiromer and ZS9 for to allow people with CKD to take renin inhibitors. But the idea is that you could theoretically treat dialysis patients with these drugs and dialyze them against a potassium of 4.5 and control the potassium on a chronic basis with this. Do you know of any studies or any interest in this area?
So back to the disclosure slide. Since I have been a consultant for both ZS Pharma and Relipsa, both, so those are the two companies that are in this space in the U.S. right now. Is there an interest? Absolutely, there is an interest. What happens is with small companies is they almost don't know where to start. So I think the main interest from a commercial standpoint is getting the drugs approved in the United States. But, looking at this as a clinician living in Minnesota with our horrible, wonderful or horrible climate, my comment on this was I'd like to have sort of an emergency Minnesota pack for people in outstate units who can't make it for dialysis runs when they're known to be, they're going to be hyperkalemic. So, yes, I think this is going to be a very good clinical tool eventually for in the space that you're describing, either chronic management, pre-dialysis, certainly people who are not candidates due to hyperkalemia on RAS inhibitors and ACE inhibitors, or people who are known to have very large potassium swings where you could buffer it between runs, or even allow you to pick higher potassium dialysate in combination with the agent. Now, I think to do that, you're going to have to validate this in a clinical population that it works. But I think the idea, makes perfect sense. I think these agents are likely to be very good niche therapies, and they're certainly going to be better than what we currently have, which is awful, which is KXLate. It's not that's about as low a target comparator as you could pick for a treatment. But what I'm hoping is that these agents will become available in the near future, and then I think they'll become useful agents for clinicians in the U.S.
Okay. Yep.
Hi. Thank you for the excellent talk, Dr. Herzog. I got a question. If you can comment briefly on use of beta blockers as a prophylaxis. I mean, this has been love and hate relationship among, I've seen a lot of attending. I'm a fellow, so I'm trying to learn these things. I mean, can you comment briefly on role of beta blockers in prophylaxis for cardiac patient with ESRD?
So, you've got evidence-based and opinion-based, so let's sort of separate them out here. I think it makes sense, but to recommend a therapy, just blanket therapy, without having a good evidence base for it, I mean that's it's not terribly good medical practice to do things just randomly. So it's nice to have a reason to do it. Now, fortunately for beta blockers, there's a large clinical indication which is well established. You know, so there are drugs like carvedilol, very good antihypertensive agents. They're, you know, beta blockers are good anti-anginals. They can be used for rate control in AFib. I mean, you can find a lot of different reasons to have patients on beta blockers. You know, I think what you're asking, though, is what about somebody who wouldn't qualify for a beta blocker for any clinical indication? Would I do it prophylactically? And the answer is, you know, I don't know, because I don't know that it actually works. I made the comment yesterday at the IRI board meeting that I think we waited about 10 years too late to do the randomized trial. There is a group in Australia, in the Australia-New Zealand Trials Network, that has a RCT pilot on carvedilol. The problem they're having is it's very difficult to enroll patients, finding people who are not beta blocker candidates, and then randomize them. So again, I'll say the opinion base. My opinion is that drugs like carvedilol probably are good things, but then the evidence base is we don't know. And I think you have to be very careful about separating the two between opinion-based and evidence-based. They're safe drugs, though. I will say that.
Hi, Bob Hootkins from Austin. Thank you so much for two excellent presentations. I had a question about why we picked magnesium levels of 0.75 and 1 mil equivalent per liter in our dialysate, and is there any data at all, since we use magnesium almost too indiscriminately in the ICU for rhythmic stabilization, is there any data that maybe going to a 1.5 dialysate magnesium concentration could be stabilizing with or without the presence of hypokalemia?
I think that's a great question. There's only one observational study I'm aware of from Japan, again, implicating, you know, low magnesium dialysate. But I don't think that this has attracted enough attention. I think it's just sort of like it's in there in the dialysate. We don't think much about it. But I can't tell you why we picked a particular threshold. I think it's more we picked it and then we forgot about it. I think I would go back to some of the old dialysis gurus and ask them and say, why did we pick this number, and does it still make sense, you know, 30 years later?
I don't remember why we picked it.
Okay. John?
Yeah, I had a comment on the magnesium. You know, in Europe, they're using osavarin, which is a mixture of calcium acetate and magnesium carbonate. And in those people, they get a fairly large increase in their serum magnesium. So I think it's really low-hanging fruit for those people who think that increasing magnesium level would help dialysis patients is to compare people taking osavarin with other calcium binders, and especially from a cardiac rhythm standpoint. But what I wanted to ask you, Dr. Hirsock, is I know it's great to talk to a cardiologist. You know, cardiologists love to put people on platelet blockers and two or three or four, however many. And all of our dialysis procedures still activate platelets, even with biocompatible membranes. And there's this whole microbubble idea that this may be causing microvascular damage. This is apart from the cardiac stunning. It seems to me to be a very neglected area, and I was wondering about the increase in sudden cardiac death in dialysis, hemodialysis versus PD. Now, this may be due to stunning, but also I'm wondering whether this chronic platelet activation that happens intermittently or for people on daily dialysis or nocturnal dialysis may happen very consistently, if that might be an adverse effect of dialysis that maybe has been off people's radar screen.
So if there were a big difference in mechanisms between PD and HD, I would expect a disproportional difference in cause of death. And there really isn't. I mean, the proportionality is the same. What's interesting to me is that from an observational standpoint, if you go look at dialysis mortality all over the world, and now it's a constant, that 25% number seems to be correct. What's very different is the all-cause mortality rate. And that, to me, is the mystery. You know, why is it so much lower, say, in Japan than it is in the U.S.? Japanese population, they have a higher stroke rate, so that's the one thing that's worse in Japanese dialysis patients. But then the stroke rate is higher in Japan, too, so it probably reflects the population and the genetics. But, you know, I think your question about the platelet activation is interesting. It really has not been implicated as a cause of arrhythmic death. I think you can make maybe a better case that it may be related to acute MIs, though. And, you know, unfortunately, antiplatelet therapy hasn't really been shown to be much of a benefit, but it hasn't really been tested in an adequately powered study either. So it's, you know, back to, do you make clinical decisions based on, you know, evidence? And the answer is, well, if you do, then you're kind of stuck because evidence implies high-quality trials. There aren't any. Or you do it based on opinion. I think on the platelet side, I think it's worth thinking about things that happen during hemodialysis. And low-dose aspirin, you know, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. It's fairly innocuous. I won't say it does still cause GI bleeds, so you have to be careful, and a few intracranial bleeds. But, you know, at least from the perspective of sudden death, I don't think that platelet activation is probably a major mechanism.
Okay. Mrs. Weintraub?
My name is Judy Weintraub. I'd like to alert everyone in this room of what a golden and special opportunity and gift we had this morning to hear Dr. Chris Black speak. Dr. Black is a very humble man, and he would never admit that he is the father of kidney dialysis in this country. And I am unbelievably grateful to Dr. Black. I consider him to be a mentor. It is because of him that I switched to nocturnal home hemo in 2002. I'm doing that for 12 years now. I've been doing kidney dialysis since April 10, 1975. That's almost 40 years of dialysis. And I am unbelievably grateful to physicians like Dr. Blagg, like Dr. Robert Lockridge, like Dr. Katanko, and several others, Dr. Tom Golper, who are unbelievable advocates for better outcomes, for quality of life, and not accepting the statistics out there. It is not necessary. In my experience, the way to address better outcomes is hands down home therapies, whether peritoneal dialysis or home hemodialysis. I'm a huge proponent of nocturnal home hemo right now. I do 7 hours, 4 times a week, and that is how I address personally the second presentation, which was awesome. I thank you very much. Addressing cardiac problems, there is nothing like more frequent dialysis and gentler dialysis. 2.5 hours, 3 times a week is so harsh on the system. The missing 3 days of dialysis going from Friday to Monday or Saturday to Tuesday, you are asking for cardiac incidences. It is dangerous. We need to lower the amount of people doing only 3 times a week in clinics in this country. That is the way to address the mortality and morbidity rates that are so high currently in the United States. So I thank you, Dr. Blagg, from the bottom of my heart for being such a strong advocate for nocturnal home hemo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I can hardly add to Mrs. Weintraub's eloquence, and I also would like to say how much I enjoyed speaking for everyone. Dr. Blagg's wonderful historical interpretation of dialysis in its earlier days. I think this talk should become part of the historical record on dialysis. The point I'd like to bring up is also what Mrs. Weintraub referred to, is your comment about 4 hours dialysis. I'd like to ask you, what do you think should happen in this country from the point of view of public opinion, medical opinion, political opinion, on making it clear that some period of duration of dialysis greater than the current, which is about 3.5 hours, I think, on average in the United States in center, should be done in order to do what is obvious. In many branches of medicine, when we see something obvious, eventually it happens. What do you think should be done?
The obvious answer would be to do a trial, but I don't think anybody will do a controlled trial on this. I think you've just got to publicize the fact repeatedly to physicians and to patients that while more dialysis, particularly in the center, may be a nuisance and interfere with your life a little bit more, the end result may be much better for you in the long run. But I don't know whether you have any other suggestions.
I don't, but I would go back to the comment about the home therapies. I mean, it's ironic that I was thinking about the comment, because when I was an intern in Iowa City in 1978 at the VA, in Iowa, a rural area, there weren't really any hemodialysis centers, and we had a program at the VA to train spouses to be dialysis technicians. It was like 6 to 12 month therapies, and the patients did fantastically well. And this is 35 years ago, because the person's partner was like the world's best and most committed dialysis provider. And that was a very good model. And then we sort of lost touch with what really worked 3.5 decades ago. So I share the enthusiasm. If I were going to pick something that would be a good therapy, actually, it would probably bite my tongue. Maybe not to have dialysis centers at all, and really push very hard to have a network of home providers, and also to make sure that people are candidates and have accessibility for transplant.
I was just thinking that, and I can't remember the exact date of this, but probably 20, 25 years ago, when Montana only had 3 or 4 dialysis units, large number of their patients were on home dialysis. Then more recently, and again, I'm probably talking about 15 years ago, they had something like 18 or 20 dialysis units and much less home dialysis as a result, because none of the units said that they had enough patients to really warrant setting up a home dialysis program. It's an interesting issue.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments, questions? If not, I'll conclude this session, and I would like to come back at 10:30 for the next session, which is also a keynote address, and brace for something real interesting stuff.